Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Free college tuition for all. It's one of the clarion calls of the progressive left today, but swing your attention to the earliest years of life, and you find that in some states, the thing that's really setting people back is not the cost of college, it's the cost of childcare, which can be higher than public college tuition. And as families try to find ways to pay, there's a financial ripple effect. Moms who want to work but have to drop out of the workforce, for example. And that's in places where there's enough high-quality childcare, let alone the parts of the country considered childcare deserts. So is it time for a national solution to what some call the childcare crisis in America? This hour on Point, opportunities and obstacles to nationwide universal pre-K. And you can join us. What is your experience with finding and paying for childcare? Why is the U.S. an outlier among developed nations when it comes to nationwide pre-K? Should that change? Or do you think the government should not be involved in funding for childcare at all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today is Caitlin Collins. She's a professor of sociology and of women and gender studies at Washington University. And she's also the author of the new book, Making Motherhood Work: How Women Manage Careers and Caregiving. And she joins us today from St. Louis, Missouri. Caitlin Collins, welcome to you.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, start off by telling us here, what do you think the big picture is in terms of the challenges that people face right now in finding affordable, high-quality childcare in America? Is it as impossible as it feels?
Yes, unfortunately, Meghna, it is. I think the issues facing most American families today is that we have no national child care system, which, as you pointed out, makes us an outlier amongst Western industrialized countries. Much of the other Western industrialized nations on our planet have figured out that providing high quality, affordable, universal care is an equalizer among families. It increases women's labor force participation, and it reduces work-family conflict, as well as a host of positive benefits for children over the course of their lives. So I think American families are struggling in ways that many other Western industrialized nations have already really resolved.
So we'll talk a little bit more about the particularities around that struggle here. But take us to how politicians have talked about this. If you're calling for a national change here, universal pre-K is something that people have discussed in the past at the highest levels of government. But have they discussed it in the right ways?
Good question. So there's a big difference in the U.S. between us talking about the value of daycare versus childcare versus education, like pre-K, right? The United States citizens have gotten behind the idea of preschool or, as we know, K through 12 education funded through the government. What we're less all on one page about, I guess I'd say, is the idea that childcare should be something that's centralized, right? We are okay supporting children in educational settings, but we often don't think of childcare as being pedagogically focused, right? In the U.S., we have very few federal standards for the childcare facilities that are available, and they vary dramatically in terms of their cost and their quality. So American families have yet to get behind fully the idea that centralizing childcare could be for the benefit of everyone. We think of families as a personal responsibility still, especially when children are young.
Okay, so that's a really important point. And is that not then, I mean, but you're not saying that there's anything wrong with that, is it being family focused and a family responsibility? So if there isn't anything wrong with that, why make this great push or this great change for a nationalized, in your word, nationalized system of childcare?
Well, the economic reality for the vast majority of American families today is that they need two incomes to stay afloat, right? And we see that the vast majority of American mothers who have children living at home with them have no choice but to work outside the home. And we see, of course, a host of benefits to women's labor force participation, not only for them, but for their children and their families more broadly, as well, of course, our economy. So I would follow the lead of folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's saying that ultimately if we're talking about feminism, for example, for women, this is about choosing the destiny that they want from themselves. And so, yes, if mothers do want to stay home with their children in the first few years of life, I think that's great. It does have consequences for their occupational attainment, their lifetime earnings, for example. Mm. But as I pointed out, the majority of families have to have two incomes. So we have to find a safe and healthy environment for these children to be raised in. And that's not the case for families across the socioeconomic spectrum today.
Yeah. So in a moment, we'll play some tape of how Republicans have discussed the need or their ideas around childcare in America. But I just kind of want to play a little cascade here of some very high profile Democrats and how they've talked about it over the years. First of all, here is President Obama in 2015 during a speech at the University of Kansas, where he urged for expanded subsidies for childcare, and he talked about it as a national economic imperative.
It is time that we stop treating childcare as a side issue or a quote-unquote women's issue. This is a family issue. This is a national economic priority for all of us.
All right, that's President Obama in 2015. California Senator and 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris also talked about childcare and early education in a campaign stop this year, Columbia, South Carolina, just on Saturday.
We've got to have universal pre-K so that our babies can start out with a leg up. Associated with this issue is affordable child care and a national policy for that.
Democratic Senator Kamala Harris there. Now, here's Massachusetts Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren also endorsing the idea of universal child care in Las Vegas on Sunday.
I believe in universal child care and early preschool. 0 to 5. Let's make that investment.
That's Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, on Sunday. Caitlin Collins, the reason why I wanted to sort of play all those back to back is that it seems to me we have this history of big ideas being put forth but very poor follow through here. What do you think is the biggest obstacle in Washington right now to moving ideas about childcare out of the sort of aspirational campaign phase and into actual policy?
I think that American citizens are behind the idea that families are the backbone of U.S. society. However, Americans, generally speaking, tend to think about families and childbearing in particular as private responsibilities. Mm-hmm. They don't think that socializing the cost of childcare is something worthy of public support. And that's, I think, where the conversation really needs to shift culturally. Understanding that children are a public good, right? They are our future taxpayers, our future workers, and raising them well is in everyone's best interest. And that means that we can't only say that that families are the backbone of our society, we have to support it materially.
Yeah. So, in fact, we should note, though, that today, as we speak, Caitlin Collins, Senator Warren is unveiling, a big child care proposal for her campaign, where she's proposing that child care should be free for families with incomes below 200% of the national poverty level. That's about $51,000 mm-hmm. for a family of four. And that those earning more would pay basically a subsidized fee based on their income, no more than 7% of their income. But I guess I'm wondering, do you see that as a feasible plan?
Well, it would bring us in line with much of the rest of the Western industrialized world, so I'm going to go with yes.
Okay. We'll talk about sort of the economic impacts of having to find affordable and high-quality childcare, but then also people are going to ask about how much is any proposal going to cost. And mm-hmm. Senator Warren's plan is predicated on the passage of a wealth tax as well. The political feasibility of that is at question. And I'm seeing here that there's some data, some analysis of the plan that Mark Zandi, the economist, says that that Warren's childcare initiative could cost the federal government $700 billion over a 10-year period, after accounting for the boost that it would actually provide the economy. So the initial numbers there on that plan. But Caitlin Collins, do you think that it needs to go sort of that far, that we need to go basically from this patchwork state and local, even neighborhood system that we have so far, thus far, to a big national plan? Is there any in between that we could more sort of politically feasibly aim for?
Well, I think that's what we already have.
Okay.
So in various municipalities, towns, counties, and states across the country, we see various iterations of, you know, universal pre-K already, right?
Yeah.
So it's this sort of domino effect, just like it was with paid family leave, right? We saw this happening in small iterations, and I think the way that we reduce disparities across the socioeconomic spectrum for families, the ways that we reduce race and class and gender inequalities is through a national system.
Uh-huh. So describe to us then, compare what we have here versus what we have in other developed nations. I mean, people often look to France, right, as the example of a nationalized childcare system. What does it look like there?
Good question. So I did interviews with middle-income working moms in Sweden and Germany and Italy, and I'm going to talk, I think, about Sweden, if
okay,
that's all right
sure,
with you, given
sure.
that they're often held up as the gold standard for
Absolutely.
Early learning for children.
Mm-hmm.
And in a place like Sweden, childcare and education are combined in an integrated system, which I think is vital. The idea that this is pedagogically focused, it's just not just, as some women in the U.S. said, it felt like their childcare facilities were just holding pens for their children, right? That's a very, very different understanding of what childcare is than a place like Sweden, where the focus is on early childhood education and learning. And everyone who works in these daycare facilities in Sweden has, generally speaking, at least a bachelor's degree in early childhood development and care. Think of how different it would be if all of the nation's children were in an environment during the day where they were actively encouraged to learn and to develop, and that they had healthy meals several times a day, right? That's completely different than how we understand it in the U.S. today.
And from what age is this available for Swedish families?
It's guaranteed from the age of one.
One through when, I guess, they enter Swedish kindergarten.
Exactly right. And then they have childcare programs outside of school hours as well once children do start school in kindergarten.
And it's entirely paid for by the state?
It's not. There's there's a sliding scale for families based on income, and fees are proportional and they're capped at a monthly maximum. And so low-income families pay nothing at all.
I see. So Caitlin Collins, professor of sociology and women and gender studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Stand by here for just a moment. We're talking about whether or not the idea of a national system of childcare is having a moment or ought to have a moment here in the United States. And we want to know what you think. Do you struggle to find affordable, high-quality childcare? Or perhaps are you one of the folks out there who doesn't think the government should be involved at all? This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the idea of a national system of childcare and universal pre-K and whether or not that's feasible in America or whether it's an idea that whose time has come in the United States. I'm joined today by Caitlin Collins. She's a professor of sociology and of women and gender studies at Washington University in St. Louis, also author of the new book, Making Motherhood Work, How Women Manage Careers and Caregiving. And we've got lots of comments coming in here online. For example, Carrie Ching Simpson tells us that what's important to note is how it would affect it being universal pre-K. The community socially, some kids would be safer at school and some people could return to work earlier if their kids were in pre-K. On the other hand, Kevin Simmons says, I don't have kids and I have no desire to pay for the care of other kids. So a couple of online comments there. Let's turn now to Stephanie Kuntz. She is director of research at the Council on Contemporary Families, a nonpartisan organization focusing on enhancing the nation's understanding about changes to the American family. She's also professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, where she joins us from today. Stephanie Kuntz, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thank you very much. It's great that you're discussing this important topic.
Well, I'm wondering, I mean, you've been following this issue for a long time. Do you see a change in American political attitudes on whether or not the government should be more involved in subsidizing or paying for universal pre-K? Or do we still have the same tensions as Caitlin was talking about in the previous segment before the break?
Well, I do think we have these kinds of tensions, but they've gone up and down in history. You know, we got very close to doing this. In 1971, Congress passed the Comprehensive Child Development Act on a totally bipartisan vote, and it was going to have the same sort of things that Caitlin's been talking about. President Nixon was actually ambivalent about it. He had his staff draw up one statement for signing it and one for vetoing it. The vetoing statement was originally very simple, and then Pat Buchanan got to him, and Pat Buchanan realized that this was a wedge issue that could help fan the culture wars, and so he persuaded Nixon to veto it with all of this talk about how, oh, you don't want to raise kids communally or the government, and, you know, ever since, it's been an uphill battle, but I think you're right that people are beginning to realize that we need to take this on now.
Well, Stephanie Kuntz, can you just, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Stephanie, but stand by here for just a moment because you talked about 1971 and we just actually have a piece of audio from that time on the day that President Nixon decided he would veto the Comprehensive Child Development Bill. This was December 9th, 1971. Here's Dan Rather of CBS News recounting the president's decision on that day.
The president says the $2 billion to have been spent on the first year for child care would be, as he put it, a long leap into the dark.
A long leap into the dark. That was December 9th, 1971. So, Stephanie Kuntz, I just wanted to plug that in there because it really got to the sort of philosophical argument that I guess you're saying Pat Buchanan convinced Richard Nixon of. But how much further have we gotten along since then?
Well, I think we are beginning to get past this idea that the very best thing for kids is to be taken care of privately. You know, let me go back to something that you and Caitlin were talking about, this idea that it's somehow that families should rear their own. Well, of course, you know, we don't want government stepping into family life and raising their kids. But just as we build as a society, we build roads for people who are going to use cars to drive from their private homes to their private work. We don't ask everybody to build the section of road that they're going to drive. And I think that what Caitlin was saying is absolutely right, that children are a vital national resource. And investing in them, people who've studied effective preschool find that actually it saves in the long run in terms of crime, lower crime, higher education, more employment, $7 to $8 for every dollar spent. So that's pretty ridiculous. But I think people who nostalgize, I don't know if that's a word, this idea that families can raise kids all on their own are looking back to a unique, short-lived time in history. It's never been true except for about, it looked like it was true for about 20 years because real wages were rising so much for men and women were excluded from the workforce and government was investing in jobs. That period is gone for good, and it didn't work out well for so many women and children that it helped spark the feminist movement. For most of society, other people have been involved. Child-rearing has not been mother's full-time task.
Right. So let me turn back to Caitlin Collins here for a second. Caitlin Collins, what do you see as other changes, sort of maybe even in the workforce itself since 1971 that maybe are getting more people to think that there has to be another way or there should be another way for regarding child care?
Well, as I pointed out, it's economically necessary for most families to have two incomes in order to stay afloat these days. And that means that roughly 70% of American mothers with children under the age of 18 work outside of the home today. And this is economically necessary for our national economy. It's also economically necessary for families, right? And so, as Stephanie pointed out so rightly, we have to find a different way to go about caring for our nation's children if we want to be for example, economically competitive amongst other wealthy industrialized nations.
Is this something, though, that is actually best left to cities and states? Because we do have several cities across the United States and states who have launched their own universal pre-K programs. I mean, people hold up Tulsa, Oklahoma, for example, as a city that's making it work and to its advantage. So perhaps, you know, in the classic American approach to these things, is this one thing where the federal government perhaps isn't the best deployment system for a new program like this, and cities and states might be instead?
I think all the evidence and academic research on this topic suggests that we need a national childcare policy. When this is left up to cities and states or counties, for example, in some cases, what we see is dramatic disparities between what families and places with universal pre-K are able to offer their kids in terms of a healthy, safe, wonderful environment for their kids to spend time while their parents work, and folks who sometimes live a few miles away across a border where that's not an option for them. This creates disparities between, for example, low-income families who have access to this universal pre-K and those, like I said, a few miles away who don't have access to it.
Right. And rural families get left out completely.
Absolutely.
So talk more about that, Stephanie Kuntz, because that I mentioned the phrase childcare deserts a little earlier. I mean, is this something that hits rural families especially hard?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've had this tremendous growing economic inequality in our society, not only within regions but also between regions, and it's one of the things that has sparked tremendous so-called populist movements that, in fact, don't seem to understand that a lot of this inequality comes precisely because we don't have any federal standards for what education should be. And some societies, some groups don't invest in it at all. Some regions, some can't afford to invest in it. Sometimes we channel money to, other kind of projects. We spend billions for giving tax incentives to corporates to provide jobs. It turns out these don't bring back money to society the way that investment in preschool and higher education and college, not college, preparation for education does. So, yes, these are big issues. And just to make sure that you have to move to one of these expensive cities in order to get this privilege, this right for your family and your child, seems to me really kind of un-American.
Right. And then when you do move to those expensive cities, the cost of that child care is so expensive, you might not even be able to afford it.
Well, you can't afford to live there.
Yeah. So let's go to the phones briefly. Let's go to Erin, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Erin, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling because, I really agree with what Caitlin said about how families really are both a public unit and a private unit in this country, and really families are the foundation of the family, of the country. So it just ends up being really, really difficult when, families are struggling to work with two incomes and then having to manage childcare, which could be like a second mortgage payment. And when I had my second pregnancy, we ended up getting twins. So it's wonderful. We love it. But three children, I can't work right now because the cost of childcare would outstrip a paycheck. And also, I really feel for daycare providers because they're really not getting paid a lot. They don't have benefits like if you have, a normal 40-hour week job with insurance and days off. So many people would benefit from this, families, people that work in childcare. And absolutely, from 0 to 5, anyone who has a child knows they're learning so much in leaps and bounds. And it's not just, colors and shapes. It's, learning how to move their body, learning so many things. It's just so crucially important.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for your call. Caitlin Collins and Stephanie Kuntz, stand by here for just a moment because I want to bring into the conversation Joy Pullman. She is executive editor of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine focused on culture, politics, and religion. She's also author of the 2017 book, The Education Invasion, How Common Core Fights Parents for Control of American Kids. Joy Pullman, welcome to On Point.
Hi there. Thanks for the invitation.
It's great to have you. So you've been hearing Caitlin Collins and Stephanie Kuntz talk about their view of why they think it's imperative upon the United States to launch some kind of national system of universal pre-K or childcare for even younger years. I'm just thinking, what's your take on that? Do you think do you like the idea or not?
I think it's a terrible idea. And as I've been listening to this conversation so far, I've noticed how much it has focused almost exclusively on framing the economy in terms that are convenient for big businesses and not on terms that women themselves think are ideal for themselves and their families, and particularly on terms that are the best circumstance for families, for children. Not part of this conversation yet is the fact that 75% to 80% of American mothers prefer to work part-time or not at mm-hmm. all. So most women do not want to be working even if, or not working full-time, even if they do have small kids or they have some interest like me. I work full-time with 5 small kids. And also, there's been no discussion of a large amount of research that we have and the highest quality studies of the largest numbers of kids in both preschool and daycare programs, such as the one in Quebec up in Canada, shows long-term negative outcomes to kids, higher special ed placements, higher cortisol levels, that means stress among the kids, higher health problems, and even in Quebec, an increase in crime. So the discussion so far has been completely detached from what Americans want, mothers want for their children, what makes children happy, and what leads to long-term, you know, health and wholeness for society.
So the studies that you were referenced to, we'll get back to those in a moment. But Joy Pullman, talk to me a little bit more about this idea of families, American women in particular, wanting perhaps not so much access to full-time child care. Because I think what you're getting at is, as you're saying, that's a model that fits if you're going to go to work, back to work full-time, 9 to 5, but that instead a lot of mothers want flexibility and that we haven't talked about
absolutely.
That enough. Yeah. So tell me more.
And if you look at the polling among mothers, one of the things that competes with childcare is they would love to have more flexibility in their jobs. And we hear all the time from corporations about how great and woman-friendly they are because they're offering programs that separate children from their mothers, you know, to put them in a daycare or a preschool all day or in other programs. But what mothers like me want is, for example, the ability, I mean, what I get to do working from home, I can nurse my baby at work. I can work in smaller amounts of, you know, chunks of hours rather than, you know, many, many hours spent away from my kids at a time, which increases their unhappiness. And so lots and lots of women wish desperately that they had access to flexible work, you know, that the regulations mm-hmm. on business were not complicating things so bad that really slotting workers' businesses into kind of the man-style economy. And I think we really still have a man-focused, a man-centered economy, and it's not fair to women and children to try to expect to fit our flexible and our biological differences into a workforce that's still geared towards
yeah.
men.
Caitlin Collins, would you like to respond to that? Because, I mean, this is something that I've heard quite often, that perhaps a childcare would be more feasible. It wouldn't be quite the stressful nightmare that it is if workplaces were more flexible, more family-friendly in general.
I agree with Joy about that. I think part of the conversation needs to be about the utility of implementing policies in packages. So many of these other Western industrialized nations that we're talking about also offer paid family leave for parents in the first year or so of a child's life, and then an opportunity for children to enroll in a public daycare facility that, again, is very high quality. And the data suggests that children thrive in these pedagogically focused environments. And I agree again with Joy that flexibility is absolutely crucial for American families. The economy and jobs today still center around an ideal worker model that privileges families that have a full-time breadwinner and a stay-at-home parent. This is disadvantageous to women in the labor force more broadly. And I agree with Joy that I think offering flexibility, which, for example, in a place like Sweden, parents with children under the age of 8 have the legal right mm-hmm. to reduce their working hours to 75% in order to spend more time with their children. Their paid family leave can also be used flexibly up until their child is 8 years old, which means that if they want to take a few weeks in the summer to spend more concentrated time with their children, they can. I think we're all on the same page here that families need quality time together, and all of us need to make that happen.
So Stephanie Kuntz, let me turn to you here just for a moment, because Joy also mentioned some studies. I'm sorry to say I'm not familiar with all of them, about various that come to various conclusions about whether or not being in childcare or pre-K is positive or advantageous to children. Joy pointed to some that suggest that it's not. I was wondering if you could help us out there.
We've got all sorts of different studies, but 20 years of longitudinal research and careful study suggests that whether or not a mother works and or uses child care has in and of itself no independent effect on how those children turn out. Much more important are the factors as the mother's education, temperament, problem-solving skills, the involvement at home of the other partner, the support systems that the family has, and the quality, of course, of the child care. Mothers during early childhood, mothers employed full-time actually often provide greater learning opportunities, some studies show, for children compared to mothers who work part-time or not at all, because they engage consciously in more of the structured developmental time care that improves. I'm not saying that it's better. I think I agree with Joy and Caitlin, that people should have choices. But you know who Joy is leaving out of the choices here is men. When we look at what people want, overwhelmingly, American men and women say they want to be able to share breadwinning and child care. And we should definitely take on the businesses who make that difficult for men or women.
Yeah.
But if we force or encourage one person to stay home and specialize in child care while the other goes and accommodates to the overwork culture of our society, what we're doing is we're making women second-class citizens in the economy and in the workforce, and we're making men second-class parents at home.
Well, we've got lots of comments.
Making women second-class citizens to give to them the control of the future by having them parent their own children directly and spending most of their time influencing the next generation.
And women are the only ones who can do that? I'm sorry, I just don't
No, I mean, my husband is a completely involved father. I'm not saying that, but it's really offensive to me to say, you know, that the person who is caring for the kids more than the other partner in a marriage is the one who's a second-class citizen. Children are precious human beings, and they are, you know, get the best when they're with a mother and a father who love them.
Well, Joy,
that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so Joy Poyman, Stephanie Kuntz, and Caitlin Collins, stand by here for just a second. We got to take a quick break. We're talking about the idea of universal pre-K across America and whether or not it's got more support now than it has in years past. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the idea of universal pre-K in the United States. Caitlin Collins is with us today, as is Stephanie Kuntz and Joy Poyman. And Stephanie, just before the break, I know you wanted to respond to something that Joy was saying about women and men and privileging one over the other when it comes to making decisions about childcare. But go ahead and respond, Stephanie.
Well, actually, I'd rather move on, because I think that all I was saying was that when you make women do all of the childcare, they have less opportunity in the economy, and the men have less opportunities at home. But I wanted to respond to this Quebec thing. I'm happy to look at that. But the Norwegians recently did a wonderful study where, instead of comparing children whose families had chosen to spend them for long times in child care and those who had not, and that may reflect differences in the families, they studied siblings, some of whom had spent long times in child care at different times of their family's life and some who had not, and they found absolutely no difference in the adjustment of those kids.
Okay. Well, let's go to the calls here. Let's go to Desmond, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Desmond, you're on the air.
How are you all today?
Doing very well. Go ahead, Desmond.
Yes, I'm kind of concerned about this before, for one reason, the tax implications of it, because what we're asking is for people to make choices and to have somebody else pay for their choices. And that creates a problem for me. Now, I got two children of my own. One is 32 and the other one's in the seventh grade. And all the stuff that had to be done, I had to pay for that. But I also made a choice to have those children. And I think everyone should pay for their own children and raise their own children.
All right. Desmond, thank you for your call. Joy Pullman, I was wondering if you wanted to respond to that, because that perception or view that Desmond have is something that Caitlin Collins brought up at the beginning of our conversation about this idea that child care and parenting is a, you know, it's a very private or private thing in America, and lots of people want it to stay that way. I'm just wondering what your thought is on that.
That brings up something that I had wanted to mention earlier, which is when, you know, one of the other ladies on this program is talking about interviewing, you know, folks in countries such as Germany and Sweden. I mean, we have to realize that these are basically social welfare countries in which, you know, the tax rate for normal people, middle class people, is, you know, 50-70% of their income. So these massive benefits that we get, you know, we're talking about, the trade-offs for that are huge in terms of the economic flexibility and the choices that Desmond is talking about. And most Americans simply aren't willing, you know, to trade away 50-70% of their income. I mean, I don't know about you, but, you know, my family pays between 15-25% of our annual income right now in taxes. And that's a huge chunk that, again, you know, we would prefer to spend on raising our kids and other things in our lives.
But Joy, so if I could just jump in here, though, I think some people might say, and we've got comments coming in online that effectively say this, that, for example, TG Estes is saying it was in the mid-90s and her child care bill for two toddlers was basically as much as her mortgage. So some people are saying they are paying that much anyway.
Exactly.
Well, right. But if you think about the economics of it, say you have government ratios for kids in pre-K or in preschool right now are 6 for babies and usually 6 to 8, you know, preschoolers to an adult. So if you divide like a decent human being salary for an adult, you know, by 6 to 8 children, then, you know, you're having to have each child pay, you know, $8,000 to $15,000 a year in care just for the care worker to actually have a living wage so they can be a person who's taking good care of the children and not a stressed out person. So the economics of it really works out a lot better if mothers just care for their own children for the couple of years, you know, that kids need to be, rather than running money through the government and through a bunch of other people to have overworked people on very low salaries trying to scramble around, I mean, and talk to their children. Yeah. The children get much better face-to-face language development and interactions from their own mother who loves them than they're going to get, you know, from the type of person who's going to be scraping by in $30,000-$40,000 a year trying to care for 6 to 8 3-year-olds. Mm-hmm.
Well, Joy Pullman, executive editor of The Federalist, a conservative online magazine, focused on culture, politics, and religion, and author of the 2017 book, The Education Invasion. Joy Pullman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Caitlin Collins, let me turn back to you here, because Joy was referencing your studies that you were talking about in Sweden there. Just did you want to respond to what she was saying?
Oh, so many things to say. So firstly, those numbers are dramatically inflated for what parents pay in terms of the average tax rates. If you add up all of the things that families today in the U.S. privately pay for, if we think about health insurance, the cost of childcare, of the cost of sending your children to college these days, if you added all that up and tacked it onto what we're paying in terms of our tax rates, we're paying far more than folks in Western industrialized nations, such as those in Sweden and Germany and Italy, where I conducted interviews. The fact that these programs are nationalized means that, again, as I pointed out, it reduces disparities between children who are, for example, raised, spend several years at home with a mom. I think part of what concerns me about Joy's comments is, again, this deeply gendered idea that moms are the only ones who can raise their children well. And I'm a little confused, because all of the United States has gotten on board with the idea that public education is healthy for children starting at the age of 5. Why can't we all get on board with the idea that public education should just start a few years earlier? I don't know of one American mom who would tell you that spending all day every day raising their kids is in the best interest of the mom or the child.
Right. So, you know, I always try to look for practical examples to learn from here and appropriate comparisons to make. So I was looking into France, for example, another place that has excellent access to high quality child care and pre-K here, of the kind that you were describing, similar to what you were describing in Sweden. And I've got some numbers here that, for example, to ensure the kind of care that parents have access to in France, the nation, France, spent about 27 billion euros in 2013. That was 1.3% of its GDP. Okay, so as a thought experiment, I thought, okay, well, what if we spent 1.3% of the United States GDP? What would that be, right? And our GDP hovers around, you know, between $19.5 to $20 trillion. So we're talking $260 billion, right? If you had the exact same percentages. I guess, Stephanie Kuntz, what I want to ask you is, when people are confronted with that kind of number, like, what's the best way to make that work in an American context? Is it through taxation? Is it through subsidies? Or, you know, for example, President Trump, during the 2016 campaign, he talked about tax deductions as a way to help pay for child care.
The tax relief for these workers will be expanded by my child care proposals that I have worked on with my daughter Ivanka. Families will be able to fully deduct the average cost of child care from their taxes, including stay-at-home parents.
So, Stephanie Kuntz, what do you see as working best in the American context?
You know, I haven't studied the actual different comparisons the way that Caitlin has. I know that tax deductions, just like home ownership, end up helping the top 20% of the population rather than the full range of people who need help. And they can also be, as Caitlin has pointed out, so uneven regionally in terms of the lack of standards and stuff. I think we have to really, we have one example of a child care system like we were talking about. Between 1943 and 1946, the U.S. ran a child care system as part of the war effort, and about 500,000 children passed through that program. I was actually in it myself. Huh. Because my mother worked as a ship worker in the shipping trade while the men were at war. Some of these centers operated on a 24-hour schedule. Some preschoolers spent 12 hours a day. They had hot meals. Older children came. My mother took me in. I was quite young. She also took the older daughter of a friend. And every day, this particular one that she took it to, she talked about this for the rest of her life, helped the kids make a lunch pocket that they could take home and share with their moms after the work. My mother said that was the best experience of her life. I did fine. I enjoyed it. And one professor who has studied the population exposed to this said they did as well, if not better, than the next generation of kids who didn't have it. So we can make this work. We're an intelligent enough country to come up with spy systems and weapon systems and the rovers of Mars, you know, we just have to make it a priority. And believe me, given the higher rates of poverty and lower rates of social mobility that America has compared to all those other countries that Joy thinks are so bad, I would say that's a lot closer to a national emergency than some of the others we've been talking about lately.
Mm. Well, I do want to note that there is a bill in Congress, the Child Care for Working Families Act. It's co-sponsored by Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington, and Representative Bobby Scott as well. As far as we can tell, it hasn't actually made that much progress, but it is there. And we spoke with Senator Murray a little bit in the afternoon yesterday and just briefly asked her about one of the reasons why she's co-sponsor of this bill regarding her own experience as a working mom.
Yes, I have experienced this. And I will tell you something. Interestingly, when my kids were young, my own parents were able to take them when I was in a pinch. But in today's economy, for this generation of workers, their parents, moms and dads, are working as well. So they don't even have that backup today.
That's Senator Patty Murray, Democrat of Washington. Let's go back to the phones before we run out of too much time. Let's go to Chelsea, who's calling from Romulus, Michigan. Chelsea, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. So I'm a mom of 4-year-olds, and I'm a full-time student. And let me add in there, I'm a certified pharmacy technician, so I do make over minimum wage. But right now, I have to choose basically between a job or state funding for child care. Because child care would take my full check if I worked right now, as little as I could work, and the state only pays for a portion. So what do you do? So I'm certainly for universal pre-K because I can't just rely on state funding and school loans right now. It's really tight, so I need to work.
Well, Chelsea, thank you so much for your call and for sharing your particular situation right now. Let's go to Carson, who's calling from Atlanta, Georgia. Carson, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's your thought?
I just wanted to respond to a couple of comments that I've heard from people who called in saying that they're not parents, and since they're not parents, they don't want to be subsidizing or paying for other people's child care. And as a both a parent and an employer, I would think that everybody would want to be in favor of universal child care because it's not just a problem for the parents. It's everybody's problem. When you're in a workplace and your colleagues or your employees aren't able to focus 100% on their job because they're worried about how they're going to pay for child care or how they're going to find somebody to take care of their kid the next day so that they're able to come into work.
Yeah. So wait, Carson, you said you're an employer as well?
Yes.
Okay. So do you see this in your business?
We're a small company.
Okay.
So for the time being, I'm the only one in my office that has children. But I absolutely want to make sure that everybody who comes to work for us, is able to put their family first.
Right.
And also do their job. To the best of their ability.
I see. Carson, thank you so much for your call. Caitlin Collins, let me turn back to you on that. Carson, they're getting to the fact that she sees that there's sort of, again, that ripple effect when parents have to think first and foremost about the challenges around finding good and reliable care, that ripple effect is felt even, amongst employers themselves.
I agree fully with Carson. I think the problem that we're seeing is that American families, women still being the primary caregivers for their children, the difficulty is that when women feel like the daycare facilities available to them economically aren't a good enough quality to alleviate their fears and feeling of guilt while mm-hmm. they're working, the United States didn't have federal regulations for things like the safety of chemicals in childcare facilities until 2013. And the only reason we passed policies at the federal level regulating childcare safety is because children were literally dying in daycare facilities. How in the world can we expect women and men to work and put their time, energy, and attention on their jobs when they're worried about whether or not their kid is actually safe in the daycare facility they can afford?
Yeah. So Stephanie Kuntz, did you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah, let me respond to this idea that somehow, we're taking taxpayers' money when we ask for this. When women can't work out of the home, when women can't work, go out of the home to work, they can't earn the kind of money on which we raise our taxes. So they're not able to contribute to the tax investments that we as a society do believe we should be investing in. So it works both ways. And as I've said, we actually have seen economic statistics that show that when women are able to go back to the workforce, it not only increases the tax revenues much more than many other ideas for increasing for investment and for giving people breaks, and it also improves the outcomes of their children enough to save tax revenues in the long run.
Hmm. Now, we've just got about 2 minutes left here to go. And Caitlin Collins, I wanted to turn back to something you said very early in this conversation, because I think it's it's at the heart of if and how the United States, moves forward in the question of universal pre-K. Because in your research in other countries, you talked about how families there look upon childcare as a right that ought to be delivered to them by the state. And clearly that view is not, it's not totally shared here in the United States. So do you think that that's what needs to change, sort of the perception of it as a right versus a responsibility?
Absolutely. And what I found in interviews with women in these European countries versus the U.S. is that indeed they did think of family support such as high quality universal child care, paid family leave, flexible schedules as rights rather than as privileges. American moms constantly used words like feeling lucky or privileged when their employer, for example, gave them time out of the workforce to pump breast milk in the office, which, by the way, they have a federal right to do. When we think of these things as something that we're lucky or grateful for, it means that we won't mobilize to get the kind of rights that we deserve, right? So the idea that families want work-family balance, to me, is deeply problematic. I'm hoping that we can spur a national conversation about work-family justice. I think the roots of parents' problems are deeply political, which means that the solutions need to be political as well.
Mm. Well, Caitlin Collins, professor of sociology and women and gender studies at Washington University in St. Louis and author of Making Motherhood Work, How Women Manage Careers and Caregiving. Caitlin Collins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Stephanie Kuntz, Director of Research at the Council on Contemporary Families, an organization focusing on enhancing the nation's understanding about changes in the American family. Stephanie Kuntz, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amato, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, and Alex Schroeder. We've had help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, David Marino, Alex Pena, and Adam Waller. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.